One of the best pieces of advice that I ever got that I actually bothered to listen to was always be in touch with lenders, because in the good times, you need to know who's lending and who wants to get money out of the door. And in the bad times, if they know who you are as an agent, it makes it easier to get the insolvency work.
Welcome to the Property Funder podcast. I'm here today with Jonathan van der Molen, who is the CEO of van der Molen Real Estate. Jonathan's got 40 years of experience or more in real estate, predominantly as an agent with a small foray into the world of trading and developing. Outside of real estate, Jonathan is an avid Spurs fan. He has 39 years of season ticket experience. He's a keen golfer and a family man. Jonathan, welcome to the Property Funder podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We've known each other for quite a few years now. Probably not done as much business together as we would have liked, but you know, I guess we've still got time. Jonathan, tell us, you know, do you want to just tell us a little bit about your career and how you got to where you are now?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me. I probably got into the property business like a lot of people. I'm not sure how many people dream of growing up to be an estate agent. So when I left school at 16, I went to work for a bank because my parents thought that was a good, stable way to make a living, good job, progression. And I worked my way through the ranks sort of relatively quickly because I was always a hard worker due to an experience I'd had in my youth. And to cut a very long story short, I found my way to a branch of one of the big banks in Swiss Cottage. And one day we got robbed, and it was an armed robbery. And basically two guys worked their way through the glass of the tills, got a double barrel shotgun stuck in my face. And they left and everything was fine. But being the only child of a very overprotective Jewish mother, I was under strict instructions never to go back there again, and basically didn't. And in my infinite wisdom, I decided that I would have a rest, have a few weeks off, because I'd made a little bit of money and thought I might just try and work out what I wanted to do with my life. But my late father, who was a sort of pretty straightforward, down-to-earth character, basically in no uncertain terms told me I needed to get a job. From when I started working, I used to pay my parents rent, and which I got back when I left home and bought my first flat, I might add. And after one sort of long night, I came out of my bedroom late in the morning and tripped up over a suitcase with a little note from my father saying, "Think it's about time you got yourself a job." And although I know he didn't really mean it, it basically got me off my backside to start looking in the local paper. I was brought up in Crookerwood in North London, and basically there was an estate agency called Talbot's in Edgware. So that's where I sort of started my career, general agency, learning my trade, canvassing, and all the things that most agents do in that circumstance.
So lots of stamps, lots of envelopes. You needed a good amount of saliva, I imagine, to make sure that the envelopes and stamps were sufficiently moistened to get them to
shut. Yeah. Correct. After we finished work on a Saturday, we had to deliver 100 canvas letters before we were allowed to go home, basically, to try and produce new business. So it was a good grounding. And then basically what happened was there was a chap who had been a former partner of Benjamin Reeves, who the well-known high street agent, who'd opened up next door. We got chatting and got quite friendly. He was a very nice guy. And he saw something in me, I suppose, and he said to me, "You're wasting your time up here. You need to go and work in the better parts of North London." And he introduced me to the chap who had the first real influence on my career, called Charles Lissack, who was the boss of Benjamin Reeves' office in, it was St John's Wood, but it was actually on the roundabout at the top of Park Road. And that was when I got my first sort of real taste of how different it is being in a primer location where the properties are more expensive, the purchasers are more sophisticated, but it was a pretty similar business. And it was basically him and myself and a couple of other very interesting characters who were quite well known in the property dealing world at the time. And basically he was out all day winning instructions, and I was doing viewings and doing deals, and was making probably quite a lot of money for somebody of 20 years old. My pride and joy at the time was an Alpha Sud Cloverleaf, which was back in the days when they were giving company cars pretty much to everybody, which was a beautiful beige colour with a walnut steering wheel. The only problem with it was if you use the electric windows too much, the battery went flat. So, but I was very proud of that at the time. I was with them for about 18 months, doing very well. Got a little bit too big for my boots. One day marched in and demanded a pay rise and various other things, at which point I was told, where are your car keys? And I said, they're on my desk. And they said, good, leave them there and off you go. So that was kind of a bit of a shock to the system at the time, although we made up afterwards that he actually probably done me a favour. And I then had a brief stint with another local agency for 6 months, which didn't work out for me at all. I had some horrendous luck, purchasers getting run over before exchange, unfortunately somebody passing away between exchange and completion. And I really just didn't think agency was for me anymore. It seemed like an awful lot of work at that point in time. But I'd met during that journey a couple of very nice chaps who are still great friends of mine called Mark Pollack and Richard Bernstone, who were the founders of Aston Chase, who are the high-end North London agency, still doing very well. And they persuaded me that I shouldn't give up. So I joined them. I kind of thought was their first employee, although they'd had somebody else who'd been with them for a few weeks and it didn't work out. So I still consider myself their first real employee. And I spent 6 years with them between 1985 and 1991 and just had the best time. And I would say they were probably the biggest influence on my career just in terms of hard work. You know, Mark in particular was a very hard worker, a bit more aggressive. Richard was a little more laid back, but as a combination, as a partnership, they were great. And I'm pleased to say we're still very good friends and we still recommend business to them.
That's good. And so what were your key learnings when you, you know, when you were working with, you know, when you were at Aston Chase, what were the key, key things that you picked up?
I think there's no substitute for hard work. I think agency, like any sales business, can I use semi-bad language?
You can speak as colourfully as you like.
Sales is shit throwing. Yeah. And basically, the more shit you throw, the better chance you've got of achieving your goal. And as you get older and a little more experienced, your aim gets a bit better. But in terms of putting the hours in, doing all the right things, systems, organising your day in advance, all the things that you need to do to get the most out of yourself, I would say work ethic probably was the biggest one, because we worked very, very long hours and got the rewards for it. And from the time I joined them to leaving, they had, I think, probably 10 staff at the time, were probably and are still the leading independent agent in that part of Northwest London. And they both still work very hard today.
I mean, I've not worked in residential estate agency. I've worked in commercial agency. Which is obviously very, it's quite different. Is it quite easy to become quite a busy fool? So you could end up being working hard, but not working very smart. Like, how did you work out how to divide your time, and how did you know what leads to chase and what leads not to chase?
I think that's quite a difficult one, because the problem with general estate agency, and one of the reasons I wanted to come out of it and started the business I did, is you're relying on people's emotions. So there was always this saying that, you know, people were going to look at, or a lot of wives were going to look at houses that their husbands were never going to buy.
And so I a lot think of tire because, kicking.
Yeah, a lot of tire kicking. And I think, you know, purchasing a home is an emotional process. It's not necessarily a financial process. And you want to buy a house that you're happy with. And one of the reasons I ended up leaving Aston Chase was that I'd had two applicants that I'd been dealing with for 5 years each. I'd shown them probably 70 or 80 properties each during that 5 year period. And they both ended up buying through other agents in the same week. And that basically, and the problem with selling people's homes is there's just not enough loyalty. So the problem you used to have is you could sell somebody a house, you could have given them a great service, but another agent could write them a canvas letter that caught them on the right day, telling them their property's double what they paid for it. and it was gone. And what I wanted to do was get into a business where I could create relationships and do business on an ongoing basis with as many people as possible.
Can I ask a question? When, because I like to think of myself as a reasonably, in the estate agency side of things, I like to think of myself as a relatively sophisticated consumer. So, but when you've bought and sold houses, for example, how did you go about choosing the people that you appointed to sell your own home in that situation?
Well, generally, I think it was a question of who had the property available. So you purchase it from that person. And my view is if you purchase it from that person, you sell it through them, which doesn't always work that way with everybody. And I think one of my sort of mantras in terms of our business is I don't think you should do anything unless you think you're the best man for the job. And that's one of the things that, or one of the many things that kind of irritates me these days is when you see agents taking on a certain type of property and it's clearly not what they do. So I think it's very important to know that you're going to get the right service from the right person. And even if the agent that sold you the property wasn't necessarily the best agent for the sale, you should have them at least as a joint agent.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's a funny one. There's parallels in what we do in that there's a breadth of lending that we can get involved in. But then there's a much narrower subset of what we're actually good at. And I think maybe in the earlier part of my career or an earlier part of Avonmore, someone might have approached us and said, you know, I've got this, you know, can you give me a quote on this type of asset? And it might be something that we could in theory do, but actually it wasn't brilliantly suited to us. And there were probably better options out there. Historically, I think maybe I would have taken the approach that, all right, we'll have a go at this and, you know, see what happens. Now I take a very different view, which is that actually if it's not exactly what we want to do, I'm much better off, you know, passing that bit of business, especially if it's a direct inquiry, to another broker to a broker, a trusted broker who I know that the client will benefit from the experience of, or to another lender who I know is ideally suited for that type of business. And the client's going to get a better outcome because I think ultimately, as you probably would agree, credibility is way more important than trying to make a quid here, you know, a quick buck here and there. I think it probably pays itself back.
Yeah, I think, look, you kind of learn with age. So when I started my first business, I was trying to be all things to all men, and basically made a mistake, a big mistake, which I sort of held my hands up to at the time because I realised I'd made a big mistake. And sometimes you just have to go through that as part of the journey and the learning curve, because often most people that start a business, it's their first business. They don't really know what they're doing. But the most important thing is to learn from your mistakes and to find a niche for yourself in the market and stick to it. I have a load of random sayings that I use during various points, but one of the great sources of upset at home with my wife is I'm absolutely useless around the house. Can't do anything technical, can change a plug or a fuse, but that's about it. So my thought is if someone could do something better than you, let them, because it's just not a good use of your time if you can't be the best at it. So I think that's very much, but you learn that over time and with experience. And, you know, part of being young and growing a business is making mistakes, but trying not to make the same mistakes over and over again.
Well, as someone who pretty dreadful at DIY, I can certainly I can certainly relate to that.
I'd say I'm hopeless, but that would be unfair to hopeless people.
Yeah, you're being too generous to yourself. So, you know, talking about how you've ended up specialising. What was the step after Aston Chase? Where did you know what was the subsequent move?
So one of the many good things about working for Aston Chase was that I met quite a lot of property developers. So people like Godfrey Bradman, Elliot Bernard, Stuart Lipton, who were all sort of legends of the business.
These are real legends, yeah.
And I just liked the idea of, I still loved agency, but I liked. And I also met quite a lot of property developers who'd done well and bought houses. And I just liked the idea of doing something where I could do repeat business with people. So in my infinite wisdom, I decided to be an investment and development agent. Now, I'd never done any of that before, but because I met quite a lot of people who'd become Aston Chase clients at the time, And basically, in 1991, which was the year I got married, interest rates were 16%, which my kids still don't believe that ever happened, but they were 16%. There was a recession. Things were difficult. I just decided it was kind of the right time to do my own thing. So I started a business called Blenheim Bishop. I kind of stole the idea of how to name it from Aston Chase because their business was named after Aston Martin and Chase Manhattan. So I went for Blenheim Palace because I thought it sounded a bit regal, and the Bishop's Avenue, which is Millionaires Row in North London. And it kind of stuck, and that was the idea. And I basically reached out to the people that I'd met and asked them what, if they were looking to buy or sell anything. I had sort of reasonably good relationships with quite a few of them. And then back in the day, the Estates Gazette, which was only postal at the time, used to come on a Saturday morning. And I would be waiting at my doormat for it to arrive, would look and see what was for sale, mark it off, call the agents, get the details in, which you generally had to wait for by post, or they were coming by fax in those days. And telephone the people that I dealt with a view of trying to do business with them. And I was quite lucky. I did a deal in my first 3 months, not a particularly big deal, although actually it was probably a decent sized deal at the time. And it was a block of 9 flats in Highgate for actually a very good friend of mine and some of his partners who are still clients today. Which we sold to an investor for £490,000. So I suppose back in those days,
if you nine flats of 490,000.
Yeah. You know, you go back, it's probably, you know, a good £5-6 million today.
Yeah,
and it kind of just went from there. And I was on my own for the first couple of years. And then when mixed use development started, sort of in the early 90s, at that point in time, the only big firms doing residential were Savills and Knight Frank. And somebody mentioned to me that with every new development that was being built, particularly in Westminster, at that point in time, Westminster were acquiring as much residential as there was commercial. So if you were doing 50,000 square feet of offices, 50,000 square feet of residential. And I basically saw articles in the Estates Gazette showing that people like Great Portland Estates, Delancey, Derwent Valley, Modwin, all those types of people were getting residential. And I basically just wrote to the CEOs and said, this is who I am. This is what we're doing. Is anybody advising you on the residential? And generally the answer was no, which was kind of pretty shocking. But I think back in those days, residential was probably a bit of a dirty word. You know, now it's a huge business, particularly with the bed sector and everything that's going on. So fundamentally it's changed. But I think back in those days, as far as commercial surveyors were concerned, residential was a bit of a dirty word. And there was probably no connectivity like there is now between all the teams in the commercial firms.
Well, I mean, that's a good opportunity actually to talk about my own experience, because although I started probably another 10 years later than that, you know, in the early, you know, early mid-2000s, when I started my career, I started my career at Cushman & Wakefield. It still had Healy & Baker in the name at the time, so name you'll be familiar with. Yep. Maybe some of our younger viewers won't be familiar with that. But they did have a residential department, but the residential department was a bit like the sort of the redheaded stepchild. And it's ironic.
I've got a redheaded grandson. He's very handsome, but okay.
The proverbial redheaded stepchild, and it was funny because, you know, you can now see, you know, as you look at even the likes of JLL. Now, JLL residential team are winning awards and all sorts now. And, you know, I don't think JLL even had a residential department at all.
No,
20 years ago.
No, they didn't.
So it just goes to show. And you're right. It's quite funny because, you know, you would have had all of the, you know, you'd have had, you know, probably in the early 90s, it would have been Richard Ellis, what has become CBRE. And,
correct.
And it would have been Jones Lang Wooten. And the big, you know, big commercial agencies would have been advising, you know, the likes of the Great Portland and Delancey, et cetera. But they wouldn't have, but they only would have been focused on the commercial element.
Correct.
And the residential would have been like, yeah, whatever, you know, who cares about that? And the irony is now that, you know, they'd get equal billing, if not the resi got more billing than the commercial these days. So obviously, a great opportunity for you at the time to sort of get some seriously good instructions that I guess your standard residential counterparts, you know, your former colleagues at Aston Chase probably weren't thinking about that.
No, I don't think it was what they did. And I'm pretty certain we were probably the first independently owned business that was selling land, new homes, development consultancy. There were a couple of other niche agencies like the Estate Office, who you're probably familiar with.
Of course.
But there weren't many people at the time who were sort of fulfilling that development role. And I can't say it was a master plan, because it wasn't. I think a lot of things that sort of happened and build businesses happened by accident, frankly, and quite a lot of those things did happen to me. Certainly my first foray into the development world, because initially we were just buying and selling period buildings, blocks of flats, and development only really came around after we'd started a new homes business and was working with some of the developers we mentioned who either ended up selling or letting the residential elements. But during the course of building the business, growing a team of people, meeting clients, one of the things that I also realized was with all of the big firms in particular, when they were selling land, they were getting the new home sales back. And at that point in time, it was a very, very profitable type of business because developers paid all the marketing costs. But I felt that I needed to do a pretty substantial deal at that point in time in order to build a business, because one of the problems with building a business, as you know, is making money in the first 3 or 4 years and building capital so you can invest for the future is quite difficult. And to cut a very long story short, in the late 90s, I got introduced to a lovely chap called Clive Fenton, who'd become the MD of Barratt London. Now, historically, the house builders had never been in London at all. And because Clive was an accountant by background, not necessarily a builder like a lot of the house builders are, he sort of got it that when you sold land, you got them new homes. And very luckily for me, I'd met a very nice chap called Mike Samuels, who at the time was head of real estate for sort of private clients at Citibank. And I'd driven him a bit crazy, to be perfectly honest with you, which is kind of probably one of the things I'm known for. But the brief story is he had a client who had a building in Hertford Street in Mayfair. And I basically called him once a week and wrote to him once a month for 6 months. He called me back. Every time he called me back, I'd miss the call. And I then got a call from a very nice chap called Anthony Pell, who I'd been put through to, who basically said to me, "My name is Anthony Pell and Mike Samuels has told me to get you off his bloody back." And so basically we sold the building in Hertford Street, showed what we could do. And the hardest thing, I think, for us and for any business is always doing that first job and getting it right. So it's very, very easy to sell yourself and tell a great story and tell people what you can do. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating. My next call from Mike Samuels was he had a private client who had a site in Park Road, so opposite Regent's Park, which had planning for 400 flats, oof, which was slightly different from everything else that I'd been dealing with in the past. Sort of probably a bit beyond my pay grade at the time. But because I'd just made this relationship with Barrett's, I said to him, "Look, I think I've got the perfect buyer for you. They're looking to make an entry into the central London market." And we basically sold it for, I think it was around £20 million, which 1999, decent price for 400 flats.
Not bad.
And we got the resales. And that was when the Blenheim Bishop new homes business was born off the back of that. And we went on basically that whenever we sold a site, we got the resales.
I mean, yeah, that's quite the watershed moment, right? For the watershed deal that really put you on the map.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of staffing and headcount, you know, you started presumably just yourself when you started Blenheim Bishop.
Correct.
How many, you know, how did the growth in the staff and the number of offices you had, like how did that look over that period of time from when you left Aston Chase to when?
Well, had one office. Yeah. We never wanted to be a local estate agency. And one of the reasons, well, there were two reasons I ended up with my office in the West End. One was my father-in-law had an office in Mayfair. And he said to me, "Well, look, you're starting your business. Come and take a desk with me." no rent, and that will be a good way to start your business, until within 24 hours of getting there, the managing agent said to me, who are you? And I said, I'm Jonathan Vandermolen. He said, what's your company called? I said, it's called Blenheim Bishop. And he goes to me, well, good news for me, but not good news for you, is under the terms of the lease here, only one business is allowed to trade from each room. So you've either got to get out and not come back, or I've got the room next door and you can have that. So that was how I ended up in the West End. And the object of being in the West End was that basically you could go anywhere in London, as opposed to being South London and being a South London agent and North London being a North London agent. So I started in one room. I then took some offices in Mount Street, had a team of four people, and then ended up in probably the premises we were best known for in South Audley Street, which is a fantastic location. We had 2,500 square feet of offices. And very luckily for me, the ground floor was designated as showroom, not retail, which meant the rent, by Mayfair standards, was pretty cheap. So we were paying, I think it was £70,000 a year for 2,500 square feet. 1,500 square feet was in the basement, but it had, most of it had a sort of 20-foot ceiling. It was fantastic space. And for that kind of money, latterly a rent review when Mount Street and South Audley Street got very posh because they put all new pavement in, at my next rent review, the rent went to £350,000. And by that time, the market had crashed. So it made sense to move out of there. But the business at its peak had 25 people in the offices. We had an investment team, a development team, a new homes team, and lettings and management. So yeah, it was interesting. Staff was always hiring, you know, is not an easy thing. And a lot of it is, you never really know who's turning up and what they're going to be like. I had a client of mine, we always had a thing about, you know, help, trying to help clients and their kids, giving them work experience. And I had a very good client of mine who basically said, look, my son's looking for a job, doesn't really know what to do with himself. Will you see him? I said, sure, no problem at all. So he came in, fantastic interview, great, smartly dressed. And I said, when can you start? He said, well, I'm going away, but I can start Monday week. I said, great, look forward to seeing you then. Sent him a contract of employment, sent it back, all good. First day, he's an hour late. So he comes in, I said, where were you? He said, on my motorbike. Motorbike wouldn't start. I said, well, you could have called to let us know, but don't worry. This basically went on for a fortnight, by which time I was getting rather annoyed. And on their Friday afternoon, 2 weeks later, I called him in and I said, I'm not really sure, you know, this is for you. I said, have you got a twin brother? And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, well, the guy that came to the interview is clearly not the guy that was coming to work every day. And he said, look, in all honesty, I didn't really want to do that. I just made my dad to do it to keep him happy. So you kind of go through those experiences. And sometimes you have people that sell themselves really well, but in reality can't deliver everything because they've overpromised and underdelivered. And sometimes it's sort of the rough diamonds that shine. But I think the key in any sales, you know, if someone says to me, what type of person are you looking for? Ideally, I'd say poor and hungry. I think that hunger is either built into you from birth or you pick it up very quickly.
I love that. Poor and hungry. I mean, for sure. I mean, you know, I wouldn't describe myself as poor and hungry, but from my background, but certainly a bit of a chip on the shoulder definitely, I think, helps. It really builds. The most determined people, I think, are people who've kind of come from lower than they aspire to be, and yep, they want to build themselves up. So I think that's absolutely great. You're obviously not a Blenheim Bishop now. So what was the process for sort of moving on from Blenheim Bishop? How did it all play out?
So by sort of the early 2000s. I've been talking to a few people who said to me, have you ever thought about selling the business? And I said, well, not really, no. It wasn't sort of part of a game plan. But because the market, if you remember in the early 2000s, particularly from sort of 2003 onwards, it was really, really booming. And because we had the different income streams in terms of the investment, the land, new homes, it was something
and the lettings business, which is probably the most saleable,
management, right? Which is the most saleable without question. It was interesting. And what basically happened was my accountant, who's a very good friend of mine, a chap called Richard Rosenberg, introduced me to a chap called Ian Marcus. Mm. And Ian Marcus is exceptionally well known in the property finance world, was, I'm not sure his actual title, I think he was MD of Credit Suisse First Boston, but everybody in institutional and in the PLC world knew exactly who he was. And by some miracle, I managed to persuade him to become a non-exec of my business. Also an applicant I'd actually also had from my Aston Chase days, who just retired as head of British Gas Property, was a chap called Roy Danzig, also agreed to go on my board. And I think bringing them along helped greatly. Mm. And in particular, if I ever used to go and do a pitch to an institution, or as is often the case with Van der Molen, that a lot of people don't have a bloody clue who we are, I would go and do a pitch, I would tell them what we do. They wouldn't necessarily be that interested, but as soon as I said, and I've got Ian Marcus on my board, they cocked their head to one side and you could see them thinking, oh, well, if he's with you, you must be okay. Mm. So that was a bit of a game changer for me. And then Ian introduced me, as you just mentioned, to Richard Ellis. And Richard Ellis at the time had just been bought by Insignia, which owned Douglas Elliman. And Douglas Elliman is the huge brand in the States. And they really understood residential and wanted them to move into residential in the UK. This was in sort of 2004, 2005. And I basically got introduced to Alan Froggatt and Mike Strong, who were the two senior people in that business, who were lovely chaps. And we somehow agreed to become their residential partner. So we changed the name of the business from Blenheim Bishop to Insignia Blenheim Bishop. And the response was massive. All of a sudden, we had this big institutional name behind us. And within a space of what felt like 5 minutes, but it wasn't, we had work from Reuters, we had work from NatWest, we had work from Network Rail, and I literally thought I'd won the lottery. And they were fantastic people. They had some great people in the organisation, a chap in particular called Derek Gamage, who's a great friend, who was head of their hotel, founder and head of their hotels business, now retired. We did a £20 million deal together. And it was basically fantastic. And I thought that was my route out, in all honesty. I thought, my God, I've got a really good chance of selling the business here. Unfortunately for me, they then got bought by CB. CB owned Hillier Parker at the time, which is the other firm that you mentioned. And CB had a relationship with Hamptons, and we got dumped. And I probably never really got over it. Not because from necessarily for financial reasons, but I just really thought we could have done great things together. Their relationship with Hamptons didn't work out in the end, although actually Hamptons are now one of our JV partners, so that's good for us. But that was probably a watershed moment for me. And at that point in time, I just decided to, I was going to sell the business and sort of move on with my life. Not retire, but sort of hopefully secure my family. And one of our clients at that time were the Chengiz brothers, Vincent and Robert, who you're probably both familiar with.
Very, very well known in the industry.
Very bright, very successful, great guys. And at that point in time, Vincent was the single largest shareholder in Humberts. And Humberts is obviously a great traditional name. And so I thought in terms of me, what we wanted to do institutionally, everyone had really heard of that name. It was over 100 years old, not necessarily known in our field, but a very, very good brand. And in October 2006, they were listed on AIM. I sold the business, became MD of Land and New Homes for the group, which sounded very grand, but it wasn't really because it was only us that did it at that point in time. And unfortunately for all of us, in 2008, the market crashed and the business went into administration.
Mm. What was the net impact on you after that? Because presumably when you were bought, were you paid in shares or there was an earnout?
I got some in shares, some in cash, some shares, earnout. So my dreams of securing my family didn't quite take place. I'd also had this mad cap idea at the time. We'd as a family, we'd been on holiday to California quite a lot, long before all these TV programs had started. We all loved the sunshine. Not that you can tell from my current lack of tan. I'll be improving that from next week. And I had this idea, we're going to sell the business, I'm going to do my earn out, and we're all going to move to LA. And I'd actually started swatting up, because you have to take examinations in the US to be a broker. But when Humberts went bust, the only decent part of it that was that I managed to buy the business back, or got given it back for a pound. But unfortunately, there was no market. So the new homes
business... Particularly for land and new homes at the time, right?
Yeah, so there was limited new homes business, so most of that was shut down. We had a lettings and management business, which was actually run by my mother-in-law, Susan, who's wonderful. I always thought I kind of worked for her part of the time. She was definitely the queen of Mayfair when it came to lettings, and she was fabulous and had a good team of people. And at that point in time, I then took on a partner, a chap called Tim Bartonlott, who's a lovely chap who now owns Blenheim Bishop. But I just, it sort of knocked stuffing out of me a bit. And I thought it's probably now time to be a principal and give it a go and see how really it really is or it isn't. So I came out of Blenheim Bishop 2014.
Okay.
Kept it going for a few years prior to that, but I kind of just felt like I'd done my time.
Yeah. I mean, that's quite an interesting time, because do you think you would have preferred to have become a principal a bit sooner and maybe really ride that kind of post-GFC wave that sort of overtook London?
Yes, in hindsight, I probably should never have become a principal, because I wasn't very good at it. But if I was going to do it, yes, the time probably to do it was between 2003 and 2008, because you had a number of lenders, most of whom were the Scottish or Irish banks, who were basically giving, as a developer or a trader, or giving away free money. You know, you could get money at very, very low rates in SPVs with no recourse. So, you know, they do say timing is everything. But I was in the midst of growing an agency business at the time. I didn't think it was, I thought it was a conflict of interest to do my own property work and property development. A lot of people don't think that. If I had my time again, would I have done it differently? Maybe I would. But I was super focused on building the business and selling it at that time. And by the time the crash came, I'd missed the boat.
So talk briefly about your experience as a principal. So what are the key lessons that you, or what were your key mistakes? What are the things that you kind of got wrong? You know, looking back, or what would you have done? What could you have done differently?
I don't really think we made mistakes. So I was in partnership with my brother-in-law, Simon Miller. I don't think we did anything wrong, but that property trading, property development is a feast and famine business. And I loved doing deals. And one of the reasons I came back to agency was I was sort of pretty much the front man. I was going out, talking to agents, looking for deals. And I came to the conclusion that most of them really weren't very good at what they did, which was part of the reason I ended up going back into agency. Mm. I wouldn't say we'd particularly failed, because we never had a deal which didn't make money. Some made a bit more than we thought they would. Some made a little less than we thought they would. But doing three or four deals a year, particularly if you were buying sites to get planning, and as we know, that planning journey is, you know, a tough gig for anybody these days.
And it's 10, 11 years ago, probably wasn't anywhere near as bad as it is now, that's for sure.
Yeah, so it's got worse, not better. And I don't care what Angela Rayner and the rest of the Labour Party say, it's going nowhere fast, unfortunately. And there's a number of other obstacles that you now need to go through, like Gateway 2. So I think it was just traction. I enjoyed doing deals. It's probably kind of the one thing that I'm good at. I enjoy dealing with people, and I found dealing with agents very, very frustrating. And it just wasn't for me. My circumstances were slightly different from Simon's. He didn't have kids. I did. And I'm pleased I tried it, because I used the expertise I'd had. You know, at Blenheim Bishop, we had a consultancy business. We got 2 million square feet of planning consents for people. So I earned an awful lot. I learned how deals work more from the inside. We had a couple of private equity funders behind us. But I just came to the conclusion that I actually just really didn't enjoy it. And I think if you're not enjoying yourself at work, that has an impact on your whole life.
Well, I mean, I definitely agree with that. You know, it's sort of... I think some people, they live to work. Some people live to work. Some people work to live. I think you and I are kind of more the work to live types. I think if you're, live to work types. I think that if you're a work to live, you know, you can kind of leave you know, you kind of you can sort of half-ass it, you know, in your 9 to 5, and then, you know, leave the work troubles at the door. But I think if you're wired the way we are, if work's not going well, you know, it definitely clouds the work's not going well, or you're not feeling, you don't get meaning. It doesn't feel meaningful to you. Then I think it has it can be severely negative towards your sort of overall well-being, and has an impact on the rest of your life. So I definitely can relate to that. I'm guessing you sort of, was it about 2016, 17 that you decided to go back into agency? Because I've got a feeling that that's about the first time I met you, was around 2017 when you came to see me that first time. So was that about the time you sort of you went back into agency, or was it a bit sooner than that?
Sort of mid 2018.
Right, okay.
I think it was, the official date was May.
Yeah.
And I basically was on my own. My one of my oldest, well, my oldest and closest school friend is a chap called Philip Green, and Philip is the MD and one of the owners of Goldschmidt and Howland, mm-hmm. a very successful agency in Hampstead, for people that don't know.
And different to the other Philip Green, might add, yeah.
Definitely different to the other Philip Green, although whenever we used to, when the other Philip Green was in his pomp, whenever my Philip Green and I used to go out, I always used to get him to book restaurants where we were going, just to see the look of disappointment on people's faces when we got there. So he had a very nice chap who worked with him called Sam Phillips. He'd been with him, who's my partner. He'd been with him for 10 years, decided he wanted to get out of general agency and sort of do what we were doing. He had a full start somewhere else, wanted to start a property finding business. And I basically said to him, look, that is a pretty hard gig. Come and share an office with me. This is what I'm doing. And in 3 years' time, we can decide between us if we think we can sort of build a business together. And that's kind of basically what we did. I went back to my roots, got in contact with all of my old clients, everybody I knew. An awful lot of those people are, we have a term for them, we call them friends first, clients second, because they're people we've known for a long time. So an awful lot of the people I've been dealing with for 2 or 3 decades, which is really, really nice. And I just decided, not to reproduce Blenheim Bishop, because I had no desire, as I was quite a bit older at that point in time, in building a huge business, but I still felt there was a gap in the market for a really good niche agency. I'd had a lot of good experiences from my past businesses. I'd learned an awful lot, particularly about the finance market. And I just felt there was, you know, there's always room for one more player if you work hard enough, basically, even though it was a very different business, because by then all the big firms were back. But we're never looking to be a big firm. We just wanted to be a small niche firm. And I think whenever you start this kind of journey, you always have some ideas about what you want to be, but you never really know how it's going to turn out.
How did you end up becoming a specialist in sort of more distressed sites, as in, you know, it had, as in meant Vandermolen Real Estate as a firm rather than you individually?
So one of the best pieces of advice that I ever got that I actually bothered to listen to was always be in touch with lenders, because in the good times you need to know who's lending and who wants to get money out of the door, and in the bad times, if they know who you are, as an agent, it makes it easier to get the insolvency work. So I'd done quite a lot of that type of work when I was at Blenheim Bishop. And when the crash came, we did work for Global Recoveries at RBS, Business Support at Lloyds, for NAMA, Investec, Dunbar, who were around at the time. So I'd had quite a lot of experience before. And not necessarily when we started the business, but by sort of 2020, 2021... when interest rates were very low, the market was just going, obviously pre-COVID, was going absolutely crazy.
It was bananas, yeah.
And there were an awful lot of people just buying property who weren't really property people, but were backing people who maybe had a good idea, or they thought it was a good idea at the time. And one of the things that we all know with property is, and every business, it works in cycles. It goes up, it levels out, it goes down. So all I've really done is sort of recreated what we did in the past. The big difference is at that point in time, there were 20 lenders. There's now over 200 or 300 maybe. And I think there is probably a lot, because there are so many more lenders, a lot of the people within those lending businesses are much younger. A lot of people haven't seen a property crash or a distressed property market before. So I think there's probably a greater need for our services. And I definitely feel that in markets like this, there is no substitute for experience. And we've got a really great team. Oh, we've got some great young people, but we've got some very, very, like me, old heads.
How many have you grown the team to now?
So we're currently a team of eight. There's myself and Sam. We've got a great guy with us called Chris Rook, who I've known for a number of years since I was with Benham & Reeves in the high streets for 40 years, who's an ex-house builder, contractor, understands planning. Two great young guys called Zach Harris, who was our first employee, and Jamie Weiner. And one of the things that we've done is we've started to expand the business over the last couple of years. So we've got a fantastic chap called Adil Rashid, who joined us this time last year as our head of affordable housing. We had what I call a genius idea, which turned out not quite to be the case at the time, but sort of early last year, the year before, the land market, if you were selling a site for over 100 units, it was pretty slim for buyers. The first signs of distress were started. And we'd done a number of package deals with housing associations, which have been very good for our clients, but were very slow and painful for us. And it takes a special type of person to kind of really understand how these types of organizations work. We'd managed to do a couple of deals with Adil, fortunately for us. And basically, we started working together last year. And whilst there are no, so with the housing associations, it's package deals, which effectively is a forward fund. None of those at the moment, unfortunately, because of the funding market. And also because a number of the contractors that all the housing associations use have gone bust, gone into administration. So they're fighting fires all over the place. Section 106 sales, again, not easy because most of the HAs don't want the smaller Section 106s from a management perspective. So a lot of that work currently is offering the schemes, no HA, going back to the local authority and negotiating a Section 106 payment and asset sales. So a lot of the HAs, mainly through mergers, have a lot of old stock that they no longer need.
They don't want to spend money on
it. Again, they've got bigger fish to fry in terms of what's coming forward with all the new regulations. And what's very interesting is none of those people in asset management have got a bloody clue who we are, but they all know Adil. And for us to have somebody in our business, he's not an estate agent because that would be unfair to him, who's got 20 years in senior roles working for HAs, was chairman of the G15, I think it's now a G12, is, you know, it's like Jim White on transfer deadline day, making a signature signing.
Yeah.
So we've started the affordable housing business. As you are aware, we started in September last year, a capital advisory business. And there are a number of reasons for that. I think it was partly from financially, you can make money from it, and we're keen to build different income streams within the business. But I think also from a sales perspective, it puts us in a much stronger position. So we'll provide indicative terms when we're selling, so a developer knows exactly what he can borrow and what he can't. When it comes to looking for offers, we're looking much more forensically than we used to. So we'll look at maybe the developer's A&L to see actually if he can get the finance, how many loans has he got from different lenders, whereas historically we go, just show us the money, because if you've got the equity to buy this, you can get the development finance to build it. I think particularly with the insolvency work, where it's very useful, is we're engaging a lot with lenders. So one of the reasons I came to see you, and I've met many other lenders, is you probably didn't have a clue who we were beforehand. So we wanted to make sure that if a receiver or administrator said, we want to use Van der Molen, your answer would probably be, oh, that bloody annoying bloke, but seems to know what he's talking about. Just give him a go to get him off my back if I've done my job properly. So one of the things that's actually really changed, which we never anticipated at all, is generally we will get some work in from a lender or a receiver administrator. Our value is generally lower than the Red Book. And what we normally hear back is, well, developer's going to refinance. Because we've met in excess of 100, and I think we're up to 130 lender equity providers now, we've got a pretty good feel whether that is going to be possible or not. Unfortunately, in most cases, it isn't. But because there's still a lot of money being raised for lending, sometimes it is. So, you know, refinancing a part-built scheme, virtually impossible. Development exit finance for finished product, plenty of that available. So a lot of it depends what the job is. And one of the good things about administration and receivership, and one of the most difficult things that we all face at the moment as agents, is the seller on planet Earth? Can he afford to listen to the market? And in most insolvency cases, they can.
Well, an opportunity for us to plug the show sponsor, Avonmore Capital, who obviously are market leaders in part complete development. But unfortunately, we can't walk on water. So there are occasionally, as you say, situations where a part complete refi won't work. So it's just, you know, if it can be done, it can be done. But sometimes it can't, you know, and it's too far underwater.
I think for developers and for traders, someone said to me the other day they thought the current market was more difficult than the crash in 2008. And I don't actually think that's the case, because there's a lot more money around. In 2008, everybody else was in the same boat. But I think if you're a property trader, a lot of our business, when we started our business, was property traders. Guys would buy sites, get planning and sell them. The planning system is so broken at the moment that anything from a year to 2 years to get planning, if you're lucky. We got introduced, we do quite a lot of work for family offices, and I got introduced to somebody probably about 18 months ago who had a big operational site for their business, which they were closing down, 8 acres, was introduced to him by another client I know very well, went to see him, told him what we do, and he said, what do you think about planning? How long will it take us? What should we do? What's the cost going to be? And I said, look, this is going to be a big mixed-use sites. We're familiar with working like this. We have a number of partners. So we work with project managers, architects, planning consultant, put a team together. I said, but in all honesty, from today, if you have planning in 2 to 3 years and get any change out of £1 million, you'll be very lucky. And the truth is, it was probably 2 million. And he turned around and said to me, you don't know what you're talking about. And I said, look, you're not the first person to say that, and you won't be the last, but I'm sure you've got friends who are property developers. Give them a call and call me back. And if you think we can work together, great. And if not, nice to meet you. Probably called me back actually about an hour later and said, I'm so sorry, I had no idea. Now I know why my friends who are developers are moaning all the time. and I think planning is, it's very difficult. If you're buying with planning to build, that's 4 to 5 years now. We all know economically an awful lot can happen in that time period. But I think that one of the things that's led to all the insolvency work is there's probably been a bit of reckless lending, but you find that everywhere. But that combination of planning, build cost, Gateway 2 now, which is having a massive impact on all developers, particularly obviously on schemes 6 stories and above, the cost of finance, the lack of equity, an awful lot of the equity that was provided 2, 3, 4 years ago have been wiped out. So for smaller developers, it's much harder to raise equity. So that build cost, borrowing cost, loan to value, and first time buyer market is making life difficult. And we have a number of clients who are far wealthier, more successful than we'll ever be. But I think this is one of those times where I'm very happy to be an estate agent, not a developer.
Well, I think on that bombshell, I think we'll bring part one to a close. Jonathan, thanks very much for joining us today. Could you just tell people where they can find you on the internet or otherwise if they want to reach out and get in touch?
Sure. Our website is www.vandermolenre.co.uk. Or you'll find myself and the team on LinkedIn, which we are avid fans of.
Excellent. Well, I've been Michael Dean. You can find me on the internet across many platforms at @property_funder. And we'll talk to Jonathan again in the next episode next week. All right. Thanks very much.